Hello, everybody, and welcome again to another episode of What's in the Box, where we like to talk about what we play in Cube and what you might try in yours. I'm here joined, as always, by my co-host, Zakiel.
What's going on, guys? Thanks for joining us tonight.
And we have a very special guest with us tonight. He's a Hall of Famer. He's the host of the Vintage Super League, and he's also a Pro Tour commentator and a Cube enthusiast, which is at the top of my list, of course, but it's Randy Bueller.
Hi, guys.
Hey, thank you so much for joining us tonight. We are so, so excited to obviously talk about Cube and have someone such as yourself on the show. So
thanks for having me.
Yeah. So for those of you who may not know Randy, he is a Wizards employee, once again, a Hall of Famer, and is in charge of the Legacy Cube on MTGO. So quick question, you know, how did you get in control of the MTG Legacy Cube? I know that you are kind of the one who hosts it and you're posting articles and stuff on the online. So can you tell us kind of a backstory to that?
Yeah, well, I mean, I worked at Wizards for 10 years. And so I know a lot of those guys. Those are still the friends that I hang out with, that I play board games with. I did leave Wizards about 4 or 5 years ago. So I'm not currently an employee, but I still play tons of Magic, and especially on Magic Online, I have played more than my fair share of Cube. And so I basically let my friends in R&D know that I felt like the Cube was getting a little bit stale, quite frankly. I mean, it felt like there was a big flurry of activity while they got Cube onto Magic Online, but then they had sort of fallen into this rut where, you know, every time a new set came out, they would add some cards in the new set. But I mean, it had just kind of gotten a little bit schizophrenic and sort of accumulated some issues. And I mean, I told them, look, I could just put together a better Cube for you. And yeah, so that's basically what I did. I mean, they took me off of my offer, I guess. And I have, I guess, evolved into R&D's go-to Cube designer at this point.
I think that's probably the dream that everyone has. Be contacted by Wizards to design a Cube. That is so awesome. So one of the questions I have for you is the previous cubes, we had the Holiday Cube, and then we had kind of like the normal cube, as you were saying. Mm-hmm. What was the choice to have the, you know, the design parameters be a Legacy Cube as opposed to just an unpowered cube, or maybe like a modern era cube or something like that?
Well, it basically started from my belief that the Holiday Cube is actually in pretty good shape. Like, I felt like Holiday Cube was working. People have a lot of fun with that cube. But at the same time, Magic Online needs more than one cube. I mean, you can't just run the exact same cube every time you want to run cube for all of time. People will eventually get tired of it. There are, and more importantly, there are other play experiences for people to do. So I knew I wanted to do something that was different from the Holiday Cube. But at the same time, I still wanted it to be a best of, right? I wanted it to be a greatest hits cube. And I mean, Tom Lapilli was the guy inside Wizards. He left a couple of months ago, but Tom was the other guy who had a lot of experience with Cube and had strong opinions about this. And we both felt like a greatest hits cube still made sense. Then the question was, how do you do a greatest hits cube, but sort of keep it away from the things that the Holiday Cube is up to? I mean, we could have done something, I guess, I mean, I want to use the word smaller, but it's not quite fair, like a modern cube or a more tightly themed cube. But we felt like the nostalgia that comes from just, you know, playing some of the most powerful cards in the history of Magic is a lot of what draws people into Cube in the first place. So we wanted to keep all of that. And then we just making it specifically a Legacy Cube, honestly, it was about just having a clean message and being able to differentiate it and say, oh, you know what? The Legacy ban list is pretty close to what we were thinking anyway. I mean, maybe we would have included Survival of the Fittest if it hadn't been on the banned list, but it gave us sort of a nice, clean, elegant definition for what we were going to allow and not allow inside the cube.
So that was one of the cards we were talking about earlier. It's like, what's not in it that we, like I run Survival, and I'm like, well, they can't run that because it's not Legacy legal. But that's, like I said, that's one of the few non-powered big cards that
It's the off the top of my head, it's actually the only one that we cut because we wanted to sort of have the, I guess, elegance of being able to just follow an existing format's banned list.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's, you know, that's really interesting because many people put a bunch of different design parameters on their cubes, obviously, and I think it's very difficult looking from the outside. What were some of the design, you know, some of the things that you had some of the problems that arose from having your design parameters be a legacy legal set. Like, you were just talking about survival being maybe one of the cards that possibly, in terms of power level, probably was about the same, if not reasonable to include. But were there any, you know, cards that you really wish you would have played, or any new cards, or like any pet cards that you couldn't personally put in but you really, really wanted to, kind of thing?
You're going to get me into the next iteration of the Legacy Cube. Certainly for me, what was most important to me was to refresh it. I mean, Cube is a fun experience, and it's hard to have a Cube which goes too far wrong, right? Because Cube is self-correcting, and Draft is just an awesome play experience. So the thing that was important to me was, A, I wanted to refresh the Cube that was there that I felt had gotten a touch stale. And, you know, there were some things in the Cube where, like, they had a tinker, but there wasn't really anything good to go get. You know, just clean up some of the stuff around the edges. But the other thing that was really important to me was to set up this pattern of updating it over time. I mean, if every time the Cube runs, we go in and, you know what, take out the cards that weren't working, or maybe update a theme if it wasn't working, you know, nerf the deck that happens to be just crushing everyone, or pull out the decks that aren't winning. I mean, for me, it's the process that's actually really important. Every time the Cube comes up on Magic Online, I want there to be, you know, enough changes that it's sort of a somewhat new and different and interesting puzzle. And most importantly, I want there to be enough changes that you never feel like, well, look, I've already drafted this. You know, I've already got my couple of decks that I like, and there's no new challenge to it. So it's actually, for me, the process of making changes over time is more important than any one thing. Yeah, I'm not sure I think there is any one sort of platonic ideal of the Cube. I mean, I don't think that there's one perfect Cube. I actually think that there's, you know, different cubes for different audiences and different play styles and different goals.
Is there a number of draft archetypes you're looking to have every time, and like make sure they're all kind of fairly
That's a great question. I definitely think that you want every two color pair to have something going on. You know, I'm not saying that there should be exactly 10, or there should be, you know, 15 for the monocolors and the two color pairs, but we definitely looked at, okay, what do these two colors do together? And that you can actually see that run through all of the draft design that R&D does for, you know, booster pack sets, and, you know, even something like a Vintage Masters that they've done for Magic Online, is they definitely like to go through and say, okay, what is this two color pair doing? What is that two color pair doing? And I don't take it as far as some of the people inside R&D who think that, okay, you must have exactly these 10. But I do like to at least understand what these two colors, you know, how should they play together? What sort of things should be going on? So, yeah, I mean, it should be in at least the sort of 10 to 15 range in terms of the number of draft archetypes that are supported by a cube, in my opinion. And I mean, I'd like to think that there are different ways to play some of the colors, and that, you know, and that there are reasons why you might sometimes play, you know, a third color or splash to add this into that other thing.
Yeah, it's good you're talking about having the different deck types, but also you don't want to have anything too narrow. Like, you know, so just because I first pick, you know, cards that go in a bunch of different decks. Like, you know, I can put Eternal Witness in pretty much any green deck I play. Same thing with Thought Cities. You know, it's not always what you want, but it goes in. If you play in black, you can usually it's good for a card. Mm-hmm. And I noticed one of the things you were talking about was trying to remove some of the trap cards.
Mm-hmm.
I think you got some feedback, some of the statistics saying that, like, the people that draft, I'll just use the good example, Eureka, that they just didn't win that much. So
what do you guys think of that? So, I mean, that's what I did. I looked at it. I looked at the stats, and it was obvious to me that the cards with the lowest winning percentages, I mean, I coined the term trap for them. I mean, Eureka and Show and Tell were definitely the most sort of egregious examples of this. It became clear to me that people who were drafting those cards were just losing more than the people who didn't draft those cards. Now, does that mean take it out? Or am I supposed to leave it in there so that, you know, some people know to avoid the trap, but some people are just like, you know what, this is what I have fun doing. I'm just going to keep drafting these Eureka Show and Tell decks. I don't care if they're good. I don't know. How am I supposed to handle that?
Well, you see, that's what I used to do, but I did it with Storm.
Sure.
I drafted the Storm deck and didn't care if it was good. If I went, like, you know, if I got Storm off three times in a draft, I was okay with that. But if you ever 3-0'd one, you felt like, you know, invincible.
No, that's a great example. Storm's a great example of that, because that is the thing that I took out of the old Magic Online cube. I mean, that was sort of, well, at least the most controversial thing that I took out. And part of it was because I felt the cube didn't support it. And a lot of the reason the cube didn't support it was because the holiday cube was just the perfect place to run Storm and still is. But no, it's a fair example. Like the way that Storm had evolved in the Magic Online cube, the sort of precursor to the legacy cube, it was a trap, but some people had fun chasing it. So I don't know. It's a tricky spot. Maybe you're just supposed to leave stuff in there that people enjoy doing, even if it is kind of a trap from a win-loss point of view.
Well, we saw that you took out Eureka and Show and Tell, but then you added like Empty the Warrens and Scape Shift. And Empty the Warrens normally being like, you know, a possible Storm finisher. Is that more like a Goblin Tribal or just?
Yeah, Empty the Warrens is in there just as a value card. It's not intended to be, oh, you know, the finisher for Storm. I just think that it's going to play well with the token stuff that's going on. You know, there's a red-white token deck that you can draft. There's a sort of mono-red. The mono-red aggro deck wanted to have cards that were a little more expensive and maybe slightly less aggressive. So, I mean, it's in there for value, and it happens to have Storm, but it's don't take it as a sign that you're supposed to draft a Storm card. Just think of it as, well, you know what? 4/6, maybe 8 Goblins is kind of a cool card for 4 mana.
Now, tell me, I'm just wondering, in testing, did anybody do anything cool with Scape Shift? Because I'm trying to think. I don't know if Valakut's in there, but.
Right, there's Valakut, there's also Primeval Titan. I mean, those are so I put in Valakut as, well, let's try some stuff. I mean, again, this is my overarching approach is change is better than leaving it the same. And so I just wanted there to be some new things going on. Maybe Valakut, it doesn't turn out to be an exciting thing. Maybe it's a trap, maybe it's boring. If that's the way it works out, okay, fine. Take it out and, you know, give people something else that they can potentially try to draft a deck around.
Okay, and while we're on topic of lands, in the first iteration of the online cube, there's a card that I believe is probably a top 20 non-powered cube card, and it was taken out for Gloom Surgeon or something, I believe. it hadn't made its way back in, and that's Sheldock Isle. And I was wondering if there's some kind of, you know, statistics you have that you don't want that in, or you just haven't got around to putting it back in.
So I think it's too good. I think Sheldock Isle, it's good in this uninteresting way that, yeah. I mean, I'm not afraid to have powerful cards in the cube, but I want them to at least be interesting, and I want your opponent to have the ability to interact with you. And it just felt like Sheldock Isle, there's nothing the opponent can do. I mean, I don't want to put land destruction in the cube. I don't think that that leads to fun games of Magic. So, you know, I don't want to have a bunch of land destruction. And if there's not land destruction in the cube, then what is your opponent supposed to do? It's like, oh, you're playing blue and you got the Sheldock Isle. You're right. It is top 20. It's so good that, I mean, the reason I haven't put it back in is because I just think it's powerful in an uninteresting way. And to me, I don't like Magic cards that your opponent just can't ever interact with.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, that's why I haven't gone back to Sheldock Isle. I certainly, trust me, when I was drafting the cube that had Sheldock Isle, I was usually blue and I would always gobble that card up. It was, cause it's a great card.
So you weren't one of the drafters that would have a draft where, Upheaval was last pick then, I'm pretty sure. Marshall put a screenshot back. Guys, it's been like probably last summer of his like 45th pick was a Upheaval. And he's like, for shame. Who are teaching these people how to draft?
Funny.
So one of the questions I have, and this is kind of always a topic of discussion in the cube community, is obviously balancing your play group. Because if we all have personal cubes, one of the important things is, you know, obviously, like you were just saying, is to have fun.
Mm-hmm.
How is the approach different on the Magic Online cube? Because you have such a competitive community on one part, and then some people just like myself or, you know, just a lot of people who casually play Magic may jump on and, you know, kind of draft the cube just because it's up. So what, you know, have you ever had any feedback or maybe any decisions that were kind of hinging upon that by any chance?
Yeah, it's a tricky issue. I mean, I think that the mono red deck is probably the place where this rears its head the most. The mono red deck in most iterations of the Magic Online cube has just been good if you're the only one drafting it. Mm-hmm. And maybe even if somebody is sniping away at like your lightning bolts, if you're the only one who really wants to draft one mana, 2/1s, you know, Jackal Pups and Rakdos Cacklers, your deck turns out great. And it's sort of brutally fast, and anyone who shows up with something kind of cool but maybe a little slow and clunky, they just get rolled by the mono red deck. And it puts up these winning percentages where I feel like if the cube was really a super competitive format, you know, if there was whatever, the cube pro tour or something, there would be multiple people drafting the mono red deck, right? It would self-correct and it would balance itself because people would be fighting over the Jackal Pups, and you just wouldn't be able to get this super amazing curve where you can just kill people in 3-4 turns. So yeah, I definitely struggle with that issue. I mean, it's sort of like you've got this giant play group, but it's clear that people don't actually want to draft the mono red deck, right? It's only the hardcore spikes that enjoy drafting the mono red deck, and there aren't enough of them to balance it out. So yeah, I mean, I definitely backed off on the power level of the mono red deck, not because it's patently unfair, but because I just feel like, you know what, the stats are in, and people want to draft other things. People want to have fun with the other parts of the cube, and they don't want to just, you know, quote unquote, have to draft the mono red deck just to keep the other mono red guy in check. So it's definitely an issue I struggle with.
I have definitely hate drafted a goblin guide or two, and like it would be around in pick six. I'm like, nope, nobody's getting this card.
Yeah, yeah.
But I mean, to be honest, the reason I got into cube is LSV was on a Magic TV video when they first started talking about it before it even came to Magic Online. And he said that he picks Vortex over Jace, like
wow.
Pack one, pick one. Like a lot of times he would, if he felt like it, that was a correct pick. And I'd never heard of. So if you're at Vortex this time, cause I've been playing maybe 6 months and was pretty much, you know, just in standard and doing some draft stuff. So I was like, okay, yeah, I've got to see what this card is. And, I read in the article you posted on the Mothership about how it was the biggest, the difference, in the winning decks, and especially the mono red deck. How important was that card Vortex in the winning percentage? I guess if you can tell us about that at all.
I mean, it had the single best winning percentage of any card in the queue. Just straight up. At the end, if you just rank the cards based on their winning percentage, Sulfuric Vortex was number one. Not Jace, not Batterskull, Sulfuric Vortex.
I believe it. I've resolved it. I've died to my own. It's like you die under your own Dark Confidant, but you know, I've died under my own Vortex before, but yeah, usually when you play it, the game doesn't last long. One of the other big things that, I really like about, the newer cube is how you've taken out a lot of the artifacts, but you still have green ramp, because you said you want to, ramp the greens thing, but yeah. You cut Awakening Zone with that. That one made me kind of scratch my head because I love that card too, but it's, was it another one of those things where it has a little bit too good of a winning percentage? That was like the best card and the easiest one?
No, it was more the other side. I mean, at 3 mana, it wasn't getting a ton of play, and I felt like I needed to give green more stuff. I mean, Awakening Zone, that is one of the cards that I cut that a couple of people, you're not the first person to comment, oh, I really like that card. I mean, it could come back. I don't think that Awakening Zone had to leave. It was more just philosophy of change is better than staying the same. I don't even remember specifically what the card was that I paired with it for In and Out.
I think Fertile Ground?
Yeah, I may have been Fertile Ground. And it may have been just a desire to have a 2-mana ramp spell rather than a 3-mana ramp spell. Because it felt like, I mean, Awakening Zone, it wasn't being drafted particularly highly. It wasn't doing particularly well. But I mean, it was in the middle of the pack. It's not like it was a terrible card either. Yeah, so the thing that surprised me when I looked at the stats actually is that green ramp wasn't winning as much as I kind of thought it would, or as much as I kind of thought it should.
Yeah,
and
that's
so in terms of decks that I thought were healthy parts of the metagame, for lack of a better word, I thought the Reanimator deck needed a little bit of help, and I thought that the ramp deck needed a little bit of help. It's like I wanted to make the red deck a little bit worse. I wanted the blue deck to not get any better, but I mean, it wasn't like it was oppressive because the red deck was the only one that was really above the pack. But then, yeah, I wanted to actually help the green ramp deck a little bit and help the Reanimator deck a little bit as well.
Yeah, notice, well, of course, you didn't change much in blue, but you also didn't change much in white. Is white kind of just, you know, you swapped a couple cards out just to change out some stuff. But is white kind of like the fair red deck? Like you can do the white aggro, or you can go more mid-range. And like I said, there's a big token theme now with Monastery Mentor and, you know,
yeah,
all the elves.
Honestly, the white weenie decks and the white red decks are doing really well. If I'm being entirely honest, that's the deck I'm most worried about. You know, if a deck is going to get out of hand, it's going to be the sort of the white red aggro. I mean, if mono red aggro turns into this, like, you know, two color more interesting deck, I'm probably okay with that. But white red aggro does quite well in the cube. I mean, the white aggro decks, the red aggro decks, and the white red aggro decks were among the best performing for sure. So yeah, I was pretty happy with where white was at, especially since I think previous generations, white was terrible. Like, I just felt like you couldn't play white. I think part of the problem is there were too many Wrath of Gods in white. And so it had this, you know, there's these beatdown creatures, right? You had your Savannah Lions lying around, but there weren't enough of them to consistently get a good aggro deck. And then you just had all these Wrath of Gods, which are both taking up space in amongst the white cards. And more importantly, they're just wiping out your weenie horde. So I wanted to have fewer Wrath of Gods in the cube, fewer sort of sweepers, so that you could potentially go wide with an aggressive weenie strategy. And I wanted to sort of give white the best weenies I possibly could. And yeah, it basically worked. I thought that the white weenie deck was in a good spot.
So looking at the changes, continuing on into black, I actually really like what you did. So you had...
Oh, good.
So you were, as you said in the article, you were talking about maybe black aggro was just very kind of difficult to decide what to change. Mm-hmm. And I'm just curious, how did you come to the conclusion to do vampires as opposed to like zombies or something from a thematic sense? Because my playgroup personally is a little bit more casual, and I actually have ran vampires in the past, and they were, you know, fairly good. Cool. I'm just curious, you know, because I remember drafting the last one, or the last cube, you introduced Bad Moon, I think, for the black aggro. So was it kind of a combination of change and statistical performance that led you to the decision to change into vampires, or, you know, what was the kind of backstory into this? Because, you know, of anything in the cube, I think black is probably the color that changed the most.
Oh, it's without a doubt the color that changed the most. It's the only one that I feel like I actually overhauled. Everything else was kind of tweaking around the edges. I mean, the specific history around vampires goes back to the initial design where I submitted a design to Wizards R&D that had a vampire theme in black. Because I know everybody's had Suicide Black in sort of all of the greatest hits cubes, and it's a little tired. It's not that good. I mean, it can be good. Like, you can win with a black aggro deck, but it's hard to get it, and it's kind of fragile, and it just doesn't put up good results. So, or at least not on average. And so I thought I wanted to try something different. And the problem that, I mean, the complaint about my vampire theme in the design that I submitted was that, well, you don't want these cards in any other deck, right? You get these kind of, because the vampires on balance, it's a synergy deck. So card for card, if you line them up against the Suicide Black weenies, they're going to look slightly worse. I mean, the way that they do better is because you get enough of them that suddenly your lords are helping everybody, and, you know, you've got Anawan the Ruin Sage and they have the Abyss and you don't, right? It's a synergy deck. So card for card, it's going to look worse. And that meant few. Nobody wanted these cards, and it felt like, well, the cube's going to have a bunch of cards that only fit into one deck. And we talked about design principles a little while ago. That's a big one for me. I like my cube to have cards that can go into a bunch of different decks. Like, I don't like my cube when it feels like, well, this is just 8 constructed decks shuffled together. I'm going to pick my constructed deck and hope I'm the only one drafting it, so I get all the cards that I'm the only one who wants. I don't think that's a very replayable cube experience.
Definitely.
I mean, it can be fun. I mean, any cube experience can be fun until you kind of understand what's going on, but I don't think if you want something that people can replay, you know, 10, 20 drafts in a week or maybe even a long weekend, in some cases, you want things to be replayable. So what I wanted to see cards that were flexible. The thing was, after we ran this cube for the first time, and so I gave in and I said, okay, fine, I get it. We'll take out the vampires. And we, you know, we took out some other stuff that was a little too narrow and sort of only went into one deck. But then in playing with this cube again, it just felt like, well, these Suicide Black Weenies, they're just as narrow. Like, they only go into one deck, and nobody even wants that deck. We've all seen it and have just started, either you roll your eyes at it or you're like, oh, I guess this is the draft where I'm going to try to make it work, right? And if those cards are going to be super narrow, taking up space in a booster pack that you don't want in any of your other decks anyway, well, let's at least do something interesting. Let's do something different. And that's also part of the reason why it's vampires rather than zombies. I just thought it was sort of more interestingly different. And I felt like there were enough of them, right? There were enough interesting lords. Mm-hmm. The zombie lords, I feel like the vampire lords are a more diverse and interesting lot than the zombie lords anyway. Mm-hmm. Like, there's no Anawan, you know, there's no Vampire Nocturnus on the zombie side, I don't think.
Mm-hmm.
I made the argument, look, black is doing terrible. Like, if you look at the least drafted cards, all the black weenies are in the bottom. Nobody wants them, and even when they draft them, they don't do well. So let's at least mix it up and do something different. And so, yeah, that's where the vampires come from. It's really the only part of the cube that I feel like I overhauled this time around.
Yeah, and that's really interesting because I feel like most people who design cubes have very... You know, they have a lot of problems designing the black section because you start adding cards like Phyrexian Obliterator, like you were saying, which kind of really only goes into mono black. And then once again, a lot of the one drops or the, some of like the mid range cards are just kind of there. So I think once again, one of the answers to that is, you know, creating an environment in which the synergy is more important, than say possibly the individual card because, once again, you are kind of stuck between a rock and a hard place with the cards that you have and what you can really do with them. So,
yeah, I'm not guaranteeing that it's going to work, but it's at least going to be different for a little while. And I do think that the way out of sort of the black problem in Cube is with a synergy deck. I mean, some people will say, oh, the mono black deck is fine. And, you know, why did you take my Obliterator out? You know, I get that. The mono black deck, I mean, not many people were drafting it and not many people wanted to draft it and not many people were doing well with it. So.
Well, yeah, and that brings, exactly. And that brings me to, one of the other topics, that was the statistics behind drafting. And I think, from a lot of from a cube design standpoint, that's something that we all kind of want, right? Mm-hmm. When you're designing a cube, a lot of times you'll have the last card in a pack. That everyone, like when you're in a draft, the last card in a pack, someone will reveal so you know what is going at the end or, you know, what isn't being picked. From Wizard's point of view, I think it may be beneficial to publish some of the statistics because say I'm a casual player and I want to jump on and play the cube draft. If I don't know any of the cards, you know, or any of the new additions, or, you know, maybe I'm looking for one of the cards that was just cut. I think it may be beneficial to say, you know, these cards are being drafted really highly, so you kind of get a sense of, you know, what's going on. I think that also can help out a lot of the people who are, you know, really, really into competitive, you know, finely tuned cube lists because they can kind of see what's popular in general. I'd just be curious to see, you know, if that's a possibility that Wizards could do. Because, for example, I think we get our, you know, our monthly emails saying what's the least drafted common or your highest drafted common or what.
Right.
So I feel like that'd be a benefit to kind of, you know, share some of that information.
Yeah, I mean, I think their hesitation is that they don't want to take away the joy of discovery. Mm-hmm. I mean, on the one hand, sure, you want to give people enough interesting statistics that they feel comfortable and that they kind of sort of know what's going on. On the other hand, I mean, Wizards doesn't want to just solve the format and tell you, look, here's what you're supposed to be doing. And I certainly know that in tweaking this cube and, you know, designing this cube, I have access to statistics and I'm using them and I hope I'm using them well. I think I'm using them well. I don't know. I mean, it's not my call, first of all. I mean, so it's sort of this is me speculating about what Wizards should do when at the end of the day, all I really am is an independent contractor. Mm-hmm. I agree with their philosophy of not giving away all the statistics. Mm-hmm. I do, you know, I don't think it would be terrible to show some of them. I don't know. It's a tricky question, right? How many stats, what's the right amount of statistics for Wizards to share?
Mm-hmm, of course.
You guys want to see more?
Well, it's like the one they do now, like, you know, your most underdrafted uncommon from like cons or something. Like they could top five that you don't draft that have good winning percentage. Maybe give you something to try something new, I guess.
Right. And they do that when it's cube. I have seen those newsletters have cube stats in them from time to time. Yeah. All right. I'll give you one though. I just opened up my stat sheet. So what do you think the non-red card with the highest winning percentage is? I already told you Sulfuric Vortex has the highest winning percentage, like winning percentage when the card's in the main deck. Sulfuric Vortex is number one. The next three are also red, but number five is not a red card.
Jitte?
It is not Jitte. I think part of the problem with Jitte is that everyone just first picks it. And so it means that like, it's not in a deck built around it. It's just in whoever happens to opens its deck.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I mean, that's my theory. I mean, Jitte is, Jeté was the highest drafted card. Like, if you look at the average draft pick, mm-hmm. Jeté is like, you know, it's 1 point something. It basically, it gets drafted earlier than everything else in the cube.
I think here the highest one, it's not red.
Right. Red is crazy. It's like 20 of the top 21 or maybe 24 of the top 25. Like, it takes forever to find a second non-red card. But number five.
Would it be? It's not red.
And to be fair, I'm counting Shrine of the Burning Rage as a red card.
That's like a Porcelain Legionnaire's a red card.
Wow, is it?
I was going to say Twin, but that's red, so I don't know. That's probably not even close to the top. I think.
Is it Monolith? That's like the only the big ramp that was left in there.
It's not Monolith. It is an artifact, though.
Oh.
Sort of. It's a colored artifact. How about that? A color-specific artifact.
Shackles?
It is Vidalcan Shackles.
Shackles.
Yeah, you look at the highest winning percentage by cards when they're in the main deck, and it is like the top 30 is 29 red cards and Vidalcan Shackles.
Wow. See, that's what I'm saying. Like, this information is sweet.
Well, thanks for having me on.
Yeah. That is awesome. That's insane.
But yeah, people are like, oh, you don't want anybody to play mono red. You're like, no, I have no problem with mono red existing. I think the red aggro archetype will still exist and it'll still be decent, but I don't want the top 30 cards on the winning percentage to be 29 mono red cards, right?
Yeah.
And you can't cut Lightning Bolt.
Right. And you know what? I didn't cut Jackalpup because it's iconic and people like Jackalpup. And you know what? There should be a couple of two power guys for on one floating around. So you know what? You cut the Satyr, you cut the Vortex, you downgrade some other stuff. I don't know.
I'll tell you, Jackalpup may be done though. They're printing the baby Zergo. This is the 2/2 for one that doesn't block. I'm like, oh, okay, I was never blocking my Jackalpup, so I'm good.
Sure. I mean, he's strictly worse than Fire Drinker Satyr already, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yes.
But he's got more nostalgia value. That's why I kept the pup instead of the Satyr. I kept the more nostalgia. Yeah.
The art of any version is way better, so that's okay.
Wow.
Oh, when are we going to get the, have you seen you can download a file and it'll give you like old borders on even new cards? That would be something.
I believe there are people who have hacked the client to be able to do that. That is, I mean, not something that Wizards has set up officially.
Yeah. Yeah. Like it's, I haven't seen them do the code, but like, you know, they give you the sweet lands for cube. But occasionally you'll see a white bordered version of something sneak in there. Do you have any control over what version you use, or they kind of put the one out there?
So the reason Savannah Lions got cut is because I only had access to white bordered versions. Like, sorry, Savannah Lions, no more white bordered cards. Maybe okay. They'll make a promo version of you at some point with black borders, but there's no Savannah Lion art that they can use right now, that they're willing to use that would existed in, it didn't exist on Magic Online in black borders, so Savannah Lion got cut.
Because like I used to remember seeing the Plow Wonder with the like 8th right. edition art or whatever, and I'm like where's the Urza's one with the ox? That's the one I want. I right. don't even recognize it until I see that one sometimes. So
totally agree. Yeah, no, I have some flexibility about recommending art, but I mean, art's fundamentally the art guy's job. But yeah, at the end of the day, I cut Savannah Lion. Rather than have a white bordered card in the cube, I just figured we could live without Savannah Lion.
You know what? I can respect that. I can definitely respect that. Any other reason you could have given me, I could have argued, but I'm not arguing with that.
Yeah, so once again, we're talking about balancing not only playgroups and the cube philosophy, but you know, is there any relationship between the Holiday Cube and the Legacy Cube? Because one of the things I was thinking is, I feel as though that there are some cards that have power levels that are in between, and I think it's going to be interesting to see how those are represented. Because, for example, in the Holiday Cube, when you can play cards like Time Vault or you know Fast Artifact Ramp and you know, accelerate off and do a bunch of crazy stuff. Sometimes some of the swords and some of the equipment or some of just the higher power level stuff gets cut off because it's either too strong for this kind of thing or you know not good enough for the Holiday Cube. So is there any representation of that that will be included in later lists, or is it just kind of, you know, it is what it is?
I am going to be the guy making, I'm also, so R&D has asked me to look at the Holiday Cube stats and make any recommendations about that. So I guess my opinion does count there for whatever that's worth. I have not dug into the stats on Holiday Cube specifically. My thinking before I dive into the stats is that Time Vault is just a little bit dumb.
Thank you.
And so I suspect Time Vault should actually be cut for power level reasons.
Thank you.
But that nothing else should.
Yeah.
What do you guys think?
I drafted it every time I saw it, and yeah. I won every time I resolved it. So that's probably a good reason to cut.
Yeah, it's just too good, and it's too good in an uninteresting way. I mean, obviously, Ancestral Recall is also good. Black Lotus is ridiculous, but at least they usually do interesting things, right? And the opponent gets to try to interact with you. So, that's kind of where I think I'm going to wind up taking the Holiday Cube. I don't expect to mess with it much. But again, I haven't actually opened up the stats yet. In terms of like, are there cards whose power level falls in between? Probably. I mean, at some level, I think that there is room in sort of cube design space to have multiple cubes. Mm-hmm. I mean, I certainly think the Holiday Cube and the Legacy Cube are far enough apart that they can just both continue to exist in approximately the space they're in right now. I think there's probably room for additional cubes. I think that's an interesting place where, I don't know. I mean, I, as a cube designer, I'm interested in poking around and seeing what you can do that's then different in kind from the two that Magic Online already has. Now, there's always going to be cards that fall in the cracks in between, right? Maybe the swords are weak for Holiday Cube, but too good for Legacy. That it could be that there's no home where swords are just at exactly the right power level. That might actually be true for swords. I'm not convinced the swords are awful in Holiday Cube.
Yeah, no, definitely not. I just, it was one of the questions that was brought up on Reddit a bunch is that there's kind of a void in between, but I feel like a lot of people don't understand the difficulty of kind of designing that, you know, with that design space is that you have to try to make it the most balanced. And once again, the overall, goal is to have fun. So.
Yeah, I mean, different people have different goals for the formats, I think. I mean, some people think nostalgia is the most important goal. Some people think, well, you should just have the most powerful cards in the history of Magic, whatever they happen to be. It sounds like you agree with me in that, no, what you actually want is, you know, make it a sort of diverse and interesting environment where there's a balance of, you know, 5, 10, maybe even 15 different decks that can be drafted and be competitive, where there is no one thing that's dominating like a Time Vault.
Yeah.
But I don't know, maybe different people have different goals.
Well, it's like in my cube's a little bit different than some. Like I have all the signets, but I don't have power, and I don't have I have a library. It's just not in there because it's graded, and I just can't crack it up and put it in my cube. But
sure.
I have a lot of artifacts, and it's mostly because Tezzeret, Age of Bolas, is probably my favorite card. Because that's with the big planeswalker when I started playing. Haven't been playing all that long. But like at the same time, I have a lot of strong green stuff. My red's pretty strong in my cube. But when I have a lot of life gain cards, I guess, a lot of red hosers, I guess. Instead of cutting out some of the red, I added a few of the not dedicated red hate cards, but, you know, cards that just as a side effect are good against red, if that makes any sense.
Sure.
Did you consider maybe, since you were trying to tone down red, maybe adding in the pro red swords? Was that something y'all tried and it wasn't enough?
We had some hosers in the cube previously. Like there used to be a Hydro Blast in the cube, and I don't like the super narrow hosers.
Yeah, that's a little too narrow.
Right. I mean, we did a little bit with, there's a little bit more random life gain that snuck in this time around. I mean, that was in part an attempt to have a more elegant solution to the red problem, like, what is it? There's an Unflinching Courage in there now, which is in part, okay, you know what? Take that red deck. So, I mean, I like having incidental hosers where they kind of naturally fit in. They don't look like they're specifically targeted, but they happen to be good against that strategy. I mean, that's totally fair game.
Yeah, well, can it kind of get cards like Spellskite and stuff like that are just good and also do that. And I think that is probably the most popular opinion on how to answer an archetype that may be too strong. And I think, just like you were saying, is a lot of the times try not to include cards that are too narrow, but cards that are just good, naturally good against specific archetypes. And yeah, once again, I mean, the difficulties of balancing this kind of thing. Like, there's so many decisions that have to be made in terms of card choice, so...
Yeah, I mean, the trick is, like, what's the power level you're balancing it around either? Like, in theory, I guess you could say, well, bring everything else up to Red's level. And those cards don't really exist. So, I mean, I went around about this for a lot. Like, are you actually curating power level? It's like, you could argue, well, it's a Legacy legal cube. You should have all the cards that are good in Legacy. You know, the Jeté, the Monolith, the Swords. And for me, my number one goal was to try to have, you know, balanced, interesting, diverse play experience and interactive play experience. So toning the power level of Red down to where the rest of the cube was at, I think is the better strategy there. But I mean, certainly you can do other things. I mean, your idea of having sort of an artifact theme without power is a totally reasonable spot. Like, you can say, okay, I'm going to have Signets and I'm going to make Tezzeret good. And now you've got the vision of what you're going to build your cube around. That sounds like a great cube to me. I believe I would enjoy drafting such a cube. Only reason, you know, go ahead.
You've played a few islands in your day, I know. So I have a few tinker targets in there.
Awesome. Sounds good. Yeah, sign me up. I mean, for me, I didn't want to go there with the Magic Online cube, though, because I felt like, okay, well, Holiday Cube already exists. Holiday Cube is where the Tinker belongs and the Tezzerets, and let's just do something different. So it is pretty light on artifacts. Largely just to try to carve out its own identity in its own space.
One of the things I noticed, it seemed like it's about the time you took over the Legacy Cube or the Magic Online Cube, was that they changed the payout structure where you had, you know, you've always had like a 8-4 or single elimination in the Swiss option, but they quit paying out any kind of packs in the Swiss form. But as kind of like I consider it a bonus. If you went 2-1, you got to basically redraft. So, you know, I usually, unless it's just a really high EV side format like Modern Masters or something paired with it, I'll just try and Swiss draft for like two weeks straight because I just like cubing. But, have you seen any uptick in like play over one side or the other? Like just because of the different payout structure?
I'm not specifically involved in that conversation, but I mean, the guy who is in charge of that has been Mike Turian, who's a buddy of mine. I mean, he was a teammate of mine back when I was playing on the Pro Tour. I hang out with him and play board games about once a week. And so, I mean, I have certainly wound up in a conversation or two. And, you know, I've always said to him, I don't want these packs. I just want to draft again. Like, if you give me booster pack prizes, then I have to go trade the packs for the tickets or whatever and then just get back into the cube draft when, you know, why do you want to give me prizes that just mean somebody running some bot network is turning a profit off of me? And I think that made sense to Mike. And so, you know, he set it up where if your goal is to sort of accumulate something of value that you can go trade, well, you can go play the 8-4s, you can try to pick up the booster packs, and but you don't have to. You can just try to go infinite on Phantom Points. So I like the way they set it up. I think that makes sense. You know, it wasn't me, but I mean, I do think it makes sense. And I said as much in conversation with Mike. The other thing that he did, which I think was pretty smart, was, you know, now when you do win packs, the packs tend to come in, you know, just the right amount to go join a throwback queue. Mm-hmm. Right. You get exactly the packs that you need. You're not going to wind up with, you know, 1 and 2 booster pack increments just sort of cluttering up your account or that you're trying to trade away. You wind up with exactly enough to go play a throwback queue.
Which I found
makes sense. I kind of like
the problem. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'd get like one Urza pack and I'd like have to spend 15 tickets just to get the other two. But now if we can just talk him into making it where you can buy one Phantom point. I get stuck on 15.
They also. You just get stuck on, I don't know. They got to collect some tickets from us from time to time, right?
True. That's what I'm saying. I'll give you tickets just for one Phantom Point. If I load back up, I'm not loading up for 10. I'll just throw 50 on there just so I know I'm good for the rest of the cube time.
Yeah. Sounds about right.
So yeah, obviously now that we have you on here, we can talk about, one of the other great things in Magic that's going on right now is the Vintage Super League. I'm personally a big fan. We get to, you know, see all of our favorite pros play Vintage. You are also playing, obviously, and are the host of Vintage Super League Tuesdays at 6 p.m. on twitch.tv/magic. So how did Vintage Super League come to fruition? You know, how did you guys kind of all come together and say, you know, we really want to play Vintage? Obviously, Vintage Masters has come out, but, what was the real driving force of trying to make a, consistent competitive weekly tournament?
It was pretty much me, I guess. I'd started doing commentary for the Pro Tour and the Grand Prix again. And so I was really getting to a place where, I mean, look, the truth is at some level, I declared myself to be a consultant and stopped looking for a full-time job. So I'm like, okay, what else can I do that will allow me to just play Magic all the time and actually, collect a reasonable income? And I felt like, with Twitch, I did a little bit of streaming on my own and it seemed like giant audience grew up over the course of an hour. And it felt like the thing was, well, how can I put this together and sort of make the most compelling content possible? So, it's like a week or two later, I was at the Pro Tour and I'm like, Luis, if I put together a Vintage Super League, you want in? And he's like, in, just no hesitation. The man loves to play Vintage. The man loves to compete. And that's really true of pretty much everybody that's been in the league. So the first season was pretty much, and it very quickly became me and a bunch of other people, right? I've got the guys helped me on the back end, on the production side, and then all the players have just been spectacular in terms of doing commentary and helping. And, between the 10 players and the production staff, I felt like that first season was really cool content. And we got very quickly noticed by Wizards, who, eventually put us on to their own Twitch channel. It actually started on my Twitch channel. And then for this season, a lot of support from Wizards saying, yeah, this is exactly the kind of thing we want both the league to where now, I mean, in my mind, Tuesday night should just be league night and just keep going forever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I definitely enjoy it. I'm a big fan. It is super, super sweet. And so for me, I I'm lucky enough to live in Washington, which I think has a fairly active Vintage community, obviously, because Wizards is here, and a lot of the people who've been playing for a long time have obviously held tournaments or, are just around. I think a lot of places such as like the Midwest and stuff, there isn't a large Vintage scene apart from the big cities. So the Vintage Super League is just an excellent, option for those of you, for people who just want to watch Vintage. It's a format that as of, up until last year really didn't have too much other than the Eternal Weekend we kind of get every year. And then, occasional tournaments, or if you're in South Florida or like in New York or something in the larger cities, you probably got some stuff, but it's an awesome, it's an awesome, awesome thing that you guys are doing.
So do you have a
Yeah, I suspected that once Vintage Masters – I mean, as soon as they announced Vintage Masters, the day I heard about that product, I knew that I was going to be drafting a ton of it. I was going to acquire Power Online. I was going to be playing Vintage on Magic Online. So, I mean, I certainly was rooting for the Vintage Constructed format to become a thing that happened on Magic Online a lot, and it basically has. I mean, at this point, the dailies usually fire. You pretty much always get pickup games in the open Constructed room or two-man queues. Maybe there are things that – over time, maybe the format can get even better. But yeah, I have a lot of fun playing it. All the guys in the league have just a ton of fun playing with it, and league's really been a blast.
Do you have a favorite couple decks you'd rather either play or see playing, I guess, against each other?
I've certainly had a lot of fun with the Blue Belcher deck that I ran in the first set this year. I mean, I'm actually trying to figure out what I'm supposed to play. We have new decks as we record this, there's a show tomorrow, but then the week after that, there'll be another set of decks. So I got to figure out what to play again. It's always this tricky balance though, where if I have a deck that I love, but everybody knows that I love it, then they're just going to play decks that beat it, right? Because know who your opponents are in this league, the way it works out.
Yeah.
And I'm at a point where, if things go well, I could actually make the playoffs this season, which would be awesome, but I got to make sure I don't sort of mess up my final deck choice,
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Blue Belcher deck has certainly been the most exciting deck this year, I think, is the Blue Belcher deck, because it's something that hasn't really been around much in vintage. And I mean, I didn't invent it, but, you know, guy told me about it and I started fiddling with it and I got it to a point where it was pretty good. And then Chris Pakula and I were working on it together. And I think that through the course of the Vintage Super League, we've really put together this archetype that just hadn't done anything before, but is now suddenly just a thing that people are playing with in vintage. So that's kind of cool.
Well, it definitely seems like a kind of a, not a paper, rock, scissor format, but you know, like if you know, like you said, if you know your opponent, you can definitely bring something that could hose their deck.
Yeah, and the Belcher deck does particularly well because it's one really bad matchup is against workshops, but the kind of guys that are in this league, we just see less workshops than I think you would see in a real vintage tournament. So you can kind of get away with that.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, yeah, if people want to check, I haven't checked the show out. Tuesdays on Twitch, 6 o'clock Pacific, and then all of the old videos are also available on YouTube. I mean, this season is on the Wizards YouTube channel, and then last season is still hanging out on my YouTube channel.
Yeah, I think I made it through most of last season on the way up to the Memphis GP a couple weeks ago.
Nice.
That bandwidth would go down, and I just it just frees up in the middle of the turn. I'm like, oh. But, yeah, I actually got to play a little bit of vintage at GP Memphis. A couple guys had decks there, so we were playing a little bit. I got to play the Hate Bears deck, which I didn't think would be all that good till I started misstepping everything they did. And
like, yeah, wow, you know, mental misstep has changed everything. Probably the most impactful card to get printed in 5 years or so.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. I remember now why I got banned in Legacy.
Oh, yeah.
I'd forgotten for a while. I'm like, oh, yeah, this card's not real.
So I just realized after this entire podcast, we never asked you what's your favorite cube deck to draft.
Oh, wow. So my approach to cube is I start out assuming that somebody at some point is going to pass me a Vidalcan Shackles. And I just draft a Vidalcan Shackles deck, whether I have the card or not. And you know what? They pass it to me often enough that it usually works out. And even if I don't get the Shackles, I wind up with something nice.
Is yeah, there no, a I mean, card?
I'm capable of drafting them on a red deck. You know,
mm-hmm.
If things go badly, I am the kind of guy who would then start picking up the Jackal Pups and try to make the best of it because things went sideways and I couldn't get blue cards. But I definitely prefer the blue cards.
Is there a card that you like so much that you'll splash for, even though you know you probably shouldn't? My card's a Johnny Vengeance. Like if I'm playing white or red, I will just jam 3 to 5 sources of the other color in my deck just so I can play him. So
yeah, I do the same thing with Shardless Agent. Something about Shardless Agent just makes me free spells.
Yeah, I think it's Edric for me. I always wind up with a green splash in my blue decks. It's just drawing cards is just too much fun.
I'm
not exactly a bad card. There's probably some bad card that I splashed for also, but Edric's the first thing that came to mind.
Well, I must say this has been one of the more interesting episodes we've had. A lot of information. Really glad to have Randy on here. And I'm looking forward to drafting the cube. I'm not sure that Vampires is going to get there, but I'm definitely going to try it at least once. I'm going to miss my Vortex, but you know that'll keep me from being the fun police, I suppose. Once again, appreciate you coming on and, you can, of course, I'm a Quad Nines on YouTube and Twitter. If you have any questions about any of the episodes or anything we might have, missed, be sure and hit me up there. And Zakiel, where can they get you at?
You can find me on Twitter at Zakiel Gordon or YouTube under Merfolk Magic 5. I think that's it. Yeah.
If anybody wants
Thanks
to
yeah.
put constructive questions at you, what's your Twitter and everything? Where can they find you at?
I'm R. Bueller on Twitter, BUEHLER, and then Randy Bueller on YouTube. Definitely happy to talk cube, limited, constructed, whatever. I like talking about magic, so happy to have spent the last hour talking with you guys.
Yeah. Thank you so much for coming on. All right, guys. So this has been another episode of What's in the Box. Thanks for listening, and we'll catch you next time.